WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The story of contemporary Africa has too often been the story of dictatorship, civil war, famine, and poverty. To understand why, it helps to go back to the history of colonial Africa, when European countries carved up the continent and ruled over it. This is the subject of Thomas Pakenham's new book, The Scramble for Africa. The book begins in 1876, the year explorer Henry Stanley traveled down the Congo River, opening up Central Africa to Europe. It was also the year King Leopold of Belgium decided to create an African empire for himself. He engaged Stanley to open up Belgian trading stations along the river. In 1885, Leopold named himself King of the Congo. Pakenham says the story of the Congo, its exploration and colonization, is the backbone of the larger story of Africa's colonization.
The middle of Africa was unknown and not just uncolonized, and the explorers were beginning to open up the secrets. And the last secret was the identity of this huge river, which had been discovered by David Livingstone, who was an explorer as well as a missionary. And the question was it the Nile leading northwards back to the Mediterranean and therefore a way into Central Africa from the Mediterranean, or was it the Congo and leading westwards and therefore a way into Africa from the Atlantic, from the west? And the man who answered that question was Stanley, explorer, and he was he proved that it was the Congo. And as soon as he arrived back in Europe, King Leopold of the Belgians commissioned Stanley to take over the Congo for himself. And I say for himself, not for Belgium, it's very important, but for himself as an entrepreneur, as a personal business enterprise. And so the Congo, from right at the beginning, from 1876 and the arrival of Stanley after discovering the river in 1878, it becomes the main focus, really, for exploration of Central Africa.
You say that the Congo wasn't a colony as much as it was King Leopold of Belgium's personal state.
It wasn't a national colony. It was a personal colony. In fact, it's the most extraordinary anomaly that one man could take over a huge chunk of Africa in his own name. And he called it the Congo Free State. Free State. I mean, that's an amazing, ironic name, of course, because it was very reverse of free. And he stocked it with very cosmopolitan officials. He hired himself, and he was he was called the King Sovereign. In other words, he was King of Belgium, a constitutional monarch, but he was sovereign and complete, all-powerful sovereign in the Congo.
He ruled with terror in the Congo. Can you give us some examples of how he treated the people from that part of Africa?
Well, the people at the beginning couldn't believe the stories about what the abuses. They seemed to be horrifying. People thought they were just smear stories against Leopold. And gradually, when the British consul, Roger Casement, was sent there and gave an official report to the British government, and this was published, became clear that the truth was even more horrifying than many of the stories. And to give you an example, the soldiers, who were actually Congolese soldiers commissioned by Leopold's state, would be sent out to force the villagers to collect wild rubber. Rubber was the most important export from the Congo, used for the new age of car tires and pneumatic tires, which was, of course, the world demand for rubber was absolutely zooming up. And this was wild rubber collected in the jungle from creepers, the rubber creeper. Anyway, the unfortunate villagers would be forced to collect a quota in baskets every day. If they didn't collect their quota, they would be beaten up. And if they couldn't collect their quota for some reason, some of them might be shot, and the soldiers would be given bullets for their rifles, and to show they hadn't wasted the bullets, they'd bring back the hand cut off, what we hope was a dead Congolese villager, and they would bring back these piles of hands to show they hadn't wasted the ammunition. But, I mean, they were absolutely disgusting things they did, mutilations and tortures, and they terrorized a large area of the Congo, the rubber-gathering areas.
Did Leopold have a phony cover story to make it seem like he was a good guy doing good in Africa?
He set himself up as a philanthropist, and it was very hard to persuade people he wasn't, because there was no way they could investigate it. You see, there was no government, no European government they could apply to and say, look, these horrible things have been done in the Congo. There was no minister for the colonies, as there was in British colonies or French colonies or even German colonies. There was no parliament where the atrocities could be discussed, because it was nothing to do with the Belgium state. You see, it was an extraordinary anomaly.
Well, control of the Congo basically eventually passed from Leopold to the Belgium state.
Yes, that was the conclusion of the reformers, the various men who formed an alliance starting in England and then spreading out with, in due course, Belgium allies and also, very importantly, some allies in America, mainly missionaries. They decided the only way of getting the Congo away from the king was to force him to hand it over to the Belgian state, because that was the only way that it wouldn't seem an anti-Belgian move, and it would not, in other words, be a plot by the Anglo-Saxons or anyone else to take away a plum asset from Belgium. It was going to be handed over to Belgium. And it took them nearly, from 1902 when the campaign began to 1909 when Leopold finally caved in and signed it away. So it was a tremendous struggle.
When the Congo switched hands from King Leopold to Belgium, did conditions improve for people in the Congo?
Oh, yes, slowly it improved. But the Belgians did try and run it in an honourable way, but a very paternalistic way, do you see? What they didn't understand was that it would one day be independent, and therefore they must gradually educate the Congolese to be able to take over and run their own country.
Why did Belgium leave the Congo in, was it 1960?
Why did they scuttle out so quickly, you mean? Why did all powers were leaving in 19... you see, the sequence of events, if we're talking about decolonization, the sequence of events was the British left India in 1947, which was more than half the British Empire in terms of people, and of course had been colonized since the 17th century. So the British were leaving the main part of their own empire. It was obvious, therefore, in due course, the British would leave their African empire in due course at some time. Momentum began from 47, when the British left India. By 57, the British were leaving Ghana. That was their first colony they decolonized, first black colony they decolonized in 57. And then Ghana set up a chain of events. And you see, by 60, the French had decided to decolonize all their colonies in Africa. And the Belgians became quite panicky about their ability to control the Congo. And, of course, there was a great war going on in the north of Africa between the French and the Algerians. So for all those reasons, the Belgians felt they had to get out. But they scuttled out in the most undignified way, with disastrous results. In other words, they were quite ill-prepared themselves, and they left the country without proper rulers. And it's been in a mess ever since, in fact.
What do you mean they scuttled out too quickly? What do you think they should have done when they pulled out?
Well, they should have prepared the country with university graduates. How can you run a country without skilled people? There wasn't a single officer in the army in Congo. Congo's, what, population of 60, 70 million now. You can't have an army with no officers, can you? I mean, it was ludicrously ill-prepared. They didn't have universities. They'd only created a university very short time before independence. They wouldn't allow Africans to go to Europe to be educated, in complete contrast with other European powers. The reason apparently was they thought they would bring back democratic ideas which would pass like a kind of infection through the country. They're probably right.
So they prevented people from getting an education and from getting skills and then pulled out. So you people who were uneducated and unskilled having and to figure out how to run a country. So, I mean, you're really putting the blame, of course, at the feet of the colonialists.
Yes. I think it's an extreme case. In other words, you asked me about the Congo and Zaire, how they compared, why it played such a large part in my book. Well, the fact is it was the extreme case when the Europeans came in, when they took over the continent. It was the extreme case when they left it. The worst things happened in the Congo, both ends, scramble in and scramble out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Pakenham. His new book is called The Scramble for Africa. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Thomas Pakenham is my guest. He's written several books about Africa. His new book is called The Scramble for Africa, and it's about the European colonialization of the continent. Well, after the European powers pulled out of Africa, there were still a lot of Western interests in Africa, the period that we've called neocolonialism. And if we look at Zaire today, Mobutu has been the ruler since, 1965? And I think he's considered to be one of the five richest men in the world, but inflation in his country is something like 2,000 to 3,000%. But hasn't he been propped up by the Western powers?
Oh, yes. It suited the West to keep one ruler, whatever his credentials, however undemocratic, provided he was cooperating with their own business and strategic interests. And the fact is, the West, I think, when we look back, we'll all be sickened by the way in the 60s and 70s, after independence, and 80s, the West was collaborating with one-party rulers, undemocratic, very often dictators, military dictators. We were collaborating with them, the West was, and America too, because of the, and we justify this not only in terms of our own standard of living and our own economic interests, but because of the Cold War. Now, with the Cold War over, America, the paramount power in the world, we're surely going to see less interest in Africa. I'm afraid this isn't necessarily a good forecast. We're going to see Africa marginalized. This is one of the big dangers at the moment, isn't it? We'll see less aid projects. But will we see a multi-party rule? Will the West take steps to say that aid will be conditional on putting their house in order in these independent African states? I don't know. Nobody knows, do they, present?
There's an interesting story in your family about a link that you had with colonialism. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, you mean about Joe Chamberlain?
Yes.
And the Chamberlain family?
Yeah.
Yes, that's rather amusing because it's my first political memory, actually. My great-grandfather was called Chamberlain, and he was the brother of the famous Joe Chamberlain, who was colonial secretary and, didn't become British Prime Minister, but had changed sides from the Liberals to join the Tories. He became the leader of the imperial lobby in England. And the second part of my book is a lot about Chamberlain. Now, from our family point of view, he was a rotter because he'd changed sides, left the Liberals. My family were radicals. And in due course, Neville Chamberlain, his son, who was British Prime Minister at the beginning of World War II, Neville Chamberlain made the famous Munich Agreement, the appeasement of Hitler. And my very first memory as a child of five in 1938 was of burning this effigy of the wicked Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain on a bonfire because he'd made this deal with Hitler in Munich. And of course, what gave it particular excitement was we knew he was our cousin, Neville Chamberlain. He was the traitor to the family, and we took particular pleasure in burning him.
So what was it like for you to be writing this book about the colonialization of Africa, knowing that there was even somebody connected to your family who was a part of it?
Well, I say, I hope I've been fair to him. I've tried to be fair to everybody. But I certainly didn't kind of let him off lightly because he was my great... Joe Chamberlain was my great-great-uncle. Yes, I didn't let him off, no.
I'm wondering if there's anything in particular about Africa that you see very differently now, having completed your book, than you saw before. I'm sure there are a lot of things, but if there's any one thing that particularly stands out in your mind when you think about Africa's present or future.
Well, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about Africa's future, particularly for the reasons I mentioned of the end of the Cold War and Southern Africa, which looked to be have the darkest prospects, now seems to have the best. And there's a very good reason for that. It is much the richest part of Africa, Southern Africa. And the depressing thing is most of Africa is desperately poor. In other words, the original hope that Africa could be redeemed by commerce and Christianity, well, they got some Christianity, they got jolly little commerce, because Africa was much poorer than the European invaders imagined. There really was no crock of gold, no El Dorado in most of the country. So impressions I got travelling round outside Southern Africa, which I say is relatively rich, the impressions were of this all-pervasive poverty. The fact is people live on mealy pap, which is their staple. They're lucky to have that. Whole families live just on a sack of grain for a month. The standard of living is absolutely abjectly low in most parts. And they will remain the poor continent, whatever else happens, long into the next millennium, I'm afraid.
Well, Thomas Pakenham, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thomas Pakenham's new book is The Scramble for Africa,